Well, thanks. Yes, I mean, that wasn't even my first visit here. I think I've been before, so Carlene is not new to me, and it's always great pleasure to be here, and I'm very grateful to Ulrike for the invitation. Actually, I did what I usually do on these occasions, which is the night before I read through the paper, cancelled lots of things, added lots of things in and borrowed pencils. There's a good chance I won't even be able to read it, but we'll try. It's a conference on historiography, of course, and I have to confess right away that my paper is probably more informed by concepts of place than concepts of time. But then, as someone once said, there's no history without a place and no place without a history. And I will begin with some reflections on history, which I think actually have several synergies with papers we've already had. The first two papers yesterday morning, for example, the first paper this morning, past and present and so on, I think it would have been quite interesting actually if we'd all seen each other's papers and had a little bit of a dialogue on the basis of that. I spoke earlier of concepts of time. Now, some of you will know Martin Heidegger wrote a text with that very title, and in it he reminded us that historical references can only really function within discourses, and that we therefore need to start at the discourse level rather than with the references themselves. We need, in other words, to understand the nature of the discourse before we do history. We could track this back through a history of the histories, even perhaps to the beginnings of history, that point at which history becomes something other than telling stories about the past. And this is examined, incidentally, if you're interested, in a recent book by Dennis Feeney called Caesar's Calendar, looking at mythical time, historical time, calendrical time. But I want to explore it in relation to the modern science of history that developed with late 18th century Enlightenment thought and was institutionalized in the mid-19th century. Following Heidegger, we might then ask just how are we to understand the nature of that discourse? Its essential character, I think, and this will resonate with other things that have been said, is that it effectively freezes the present, so that the present takes on something like an autonomy character rather than a dependency character. As Michel de Certeau has pointed out, a line is drawn between past and present, though quite where the past ends and the present begins is something of a question. This then enables an autonomous present to appropriate the past rather than to assimilate it. Assimilation does not produce modern history. From this self-absorbed present, synonymous with the modern, historical references then become points in a picture. And one somehow has the illusion that this picture is rather stable. For cultural histories, it tends to be configured as so-called traditions with which the modern can negotiate. The comforts of classification are very seductive here and very dear to the historian. Now, already I'm in the territory of grand narratives, and that is indeed the territory of modernist history. I suggested earlier that this is a story we can track back to the mid-19th century, the point at which cultural modernism really began, in my view, in the sense that it started to create its own past at that time. Where music is concerned, I would associate this especially with the Weimar debates of the 1850s. I could elaborate on that periodization, but I prefer to point out that it is precisely a modernist discourse of history that dictates one of the mechanisms by which we periodize in the first place. Karl Dahlhaus has been mentioned several times in these sessions, and he dictated the mechanism, he articulated this mechanism. What really happens is that a particular story is isolated from other possible stories. It unfolds as an organic development from creation to dissolution, and the supposed climax of this development is represented as a kind of ideal, a kairos, or point of perfection. It's this ideal that in turn allows us to generate an essence that is presumed to characterize the period as a whole. And this modernist approach tends to locate music history within a history, a wider history of human consciousness. And incidentally, it also tends to point us towards significant musical works. But we might punctuate music history in very different ways. We might, for example, draw on the literary critic Derek Attridge, or perhaps at a greater distance, the philosopher Alain Badiou, by allowing for the new directions, the alternative visions, even the explosive transformative innovations that become possible through human agency in direct response to what both these writers call events, with their accompanying eventual sites, Badiou's term. The mini-history, if you like, that forms the hidden intertwining backgrounds to events. Events is a loaded term here, linked by Badiou very much to subjectivity in the sense that you can't have a subject without events. Music history then would not be about stable structures, but rather about agencies, about actions occurring within a practice and often diverging from the ethos of the practice, just as on another level the interests of practices may diverge from those of the institutions that house them, something most of us know only too well. Now, focusing on events, on transformative moments, draws our attention away from epochs and essences, rationalizations after the event, and rather towards the moment of change itself, even if this does have to involve an act of recovery. In my book on Liszt, I actually had two subheadings at one point, one an active present and the other a recovered past. It's an approach that tends to locate music history within a wider history of human communication rather than human consciousness. And one effect of that is to remove us from the territory of grand narratives and to direct us instead towards little stories, which have a way of constantly wandering away from the simple characterizations of our grand narratives. I'm myself very sympathetic to little stories, so incidentally is Christopher Page. Indeed, my own instinct as a historian is to place little stories alongside grand narratives, to treat the two in a kind of counterpoint. Little stories can speak into grand narratives in several ways. They can instantiate them, light them up, critique them, deconstruct them. By focusing on marginalia, they enable us to see around the edges of familiar, canonized portraits of music, musicians, and music making. Some of the work I've been doing in Southeast Europe is about little stories in just this sense. And I want to illustrate it today by telling you three separate stories about Greece and its neighbours. So we're now actually heading to the deep south from the icy north. As the title Greece and its Neighbours suggests, these stories are really about boundaries. Of course, if we study boundaries, we foreground divisions right away. Whereas if we study spaces, we allow that there might be unities. I'm interested today in some of the tensions that arise when you shift your perspective from boundaries to spaces and back again. And very often they are tensions between politics and culture. My three stories take us round the political borders of Greece from west to east. You have to kind of get a mental map of this region in your head. I actually have a physical one, but I don't put it up because I don't trust my command of the technologies. First, the border with Albania, the west. Then with Yugoslavia and Bulgaria in communist times. And finally with Turkey. So my boundaries are political in the main, but I'll be crossing other boundaries too. My stories map very roughly onto pre-modern, modern, and post-modern cultures. And these are associated respectively with traditional music, what I notice people are calling folk music a lot here, though I don't like that term. Traditional music, art music, and popular music. And part of the point of my current work is to try and break down barriers of this kind in scholarship. I'm going to begin with an example. I recorded this actually 3 years ago in the town of Permeti in southern Albania, and I do apologize, it's not a good recording, either visually or orally. According to UNESCO, what you've just seen and heard is an example of, quote, Albanian folk esopolyphony. Since 2003, UNESCO has had a policy of safeguarding what it calls masterpieces of the oral and intangible heritage of humanity. Probably many of you know this. Now, at its meeting in Abu Dhabi 2 years ago, the relevant UNESCO committee did remark on some of the anomalies in this exercise. There's the term masterpiece for a start. And there's the fact that the repertories are classified by nation, mainly, of course, because they're nominated by nations. The discussions in Abu Dhabi did result in some changes to the criteria. Last year, as you may know, tango was added to the list. But they have no retrospective force. So we're stuck with Albanian folk esopolyphony. And it won't surprise you in the least to hear that there is a very similar music across the political border in Greece. It's not a unified tradition exactly. Some idioms in Albania have a highly distinctive rhythmicized ezong or drone. You'll hear an example later. And that's not usually found in Greece. Nevertheless, epirotic polyphony, whether Greek or Albanian, is a defined tradition. You know it when you hear it. And actually that sound will be like a kind of reference point for this lecture. If you study Greek and Albanian literature about this music, and there is quite a bit, you'll see how two mutually incompatible national traditions have been constructed around it. And you'll see how each tradition is given historical depth, returning as respectively to Hellenic and Illyrian antiquity. This exhibits a familiar enough pattern. Music has to belong to someone to have an identity, it seems, and as political borders force cultural communities either side of a line, invented histories validate the new spaces. There is, however, a complicating factor. I don't know about your linguistic skills. I wonder if anyone here could have been in a position to recognize that the language being spoken and sung there was actually neither Greek nor Albanian. Rather, it was a dialect of Arumanian, an Eastern Romance language. And the people you saw in that video were in fact Vlachs. And Vlachs don't belong within either of our two national narratives. They're a linguistic minority within each of them. I'm not going to get into the details of how the two nation states have handled this particular group. And actually, a third national narrative is very much involved. Following the Second Balkan War, Vlachs officially became a Romanian minority in Greece, and Romanian schools and churches began to appear in Epirus in the wake of the Treaty of Bucharest. From this point onwards, Romania pressed its claims intermittently and policies of patriation were pursued. I've been speaking about the Vlachs here as though they are a single group, which is not at all the case. Nor do they articulate a single politics. You'll hear very different stories about identity if you travel around the Vlach villages of Epirus and Western Macedonia, or indeed if you simply trawl the blogs on the internet, which I have to warn you is not always an edifying thing to do in this particular case. What you'll encounter, for example, a pro-Romanian faction. It has its heroes, its history. You'll find assimilationists, Greek Vlachs, for instance, who are insulted to be called a minority, given what they and their forefathers did for Greece. And you'll meet nationalists, if that's the right word, members of the Vlach Association in Albania, or the Pan-Hellenic Association of Vlachs, who resist assimilation to any national culture, who demand language rights in education, hold annual conferences on Vlach culture, and so on and so forth. It's hardly surprising that one encounters highly defensive self-representations among minorities such as the Vlachs of Epirus. They can often present in extreme form a tension we may all recognize in some degree, for we can all feel simultaneously centered and de-centered. Wherever I am is the center, has to be the center. But not everyone will agree, and I may be persuaded by the others. It's not unusual then to find minority communities sidelined by the narratives of a dominant culture, while at the same time mimicking those same narratives. In this way, Vlachs can find themselves impossibly caught between antithetical stories about their own cultural identities, some based on external modelling, others on dubious notions of authenticity and lineage. To deconstruct such stories is a job for scholarship, and likewise stories about Greek and Albanian cultural historical claims. And I do want to be clear about why I think it's important to do this work. It's not to do with reifying traditional cultures in a spirit of nostalgia, presenting them as lyrical and stable and somehow free of internal contradiction. You don't do traditional cultures any favours at all by this kind of idealization. Actually, I think you'd respect them more if you critique them. Nor is it about therapy. This music has no real capacity to glue back together cultures that have been split apart by nationalism. I'm not really interested in ideas of music mystically transcending ideology in some way. What it is about is getting the history right as we can. And you can do that by peeling away layers of history through detailed comparative study of the several surviving species of this music and of neighbouring music. Someone was talking, I can't remember who, in an earlier paper about the difficulties involved in histories of folk music and so on, for obvious reasons. I don't think one should be totally defeatist about it. Comparative study of this kind can reveal with surprising specificity underlying cultural substrata. You can learn from the structure of melodies, for example, where polyphonic traditions once existed but exist no more. A case in point here would be Western Macedonia, where there is no existing polyphonic structure. If you look at the melodies, you can see that there once was. In other words, that this polyphonic region was once much wider and that it has contracted. You can discover how formal features in polyphonic practices in one place took their origins from ancient vocal cries, still alive as such in another place. You can go on to trace the links that exist between the Epirotic tradition and related traditions in the Dinaric Alps and even as far afield as the Austrian Alps. This doesn't mean that all cultural boundaries are soft. You can quickly tell when you take a short step across a major cultural fault line. Just cross the Danube from the Dinaric to the Transylvanian Alps and you're in a different musical world. There are families here. It's just that they don't have anything to do with political boundaries. This kind of research demonstrates evidence-based continuities rather than crude survivalist theories, and it reveals the fluidity of borders within shared cultural spaces rather than the firm lines drawn by nationalist politics. What it firmly squashes are the blatantly national stories that are still told by some scholars today. And that's important because these stories are an easy prey to appropriation. It's by getting the history right, as I put it earlier, that we create a bulwark against the abuse of the past by the powerful. Or, to put it another way, the abuse of culture by politics. To introduce my second story, I would like to play the opening of a violin concerto in which that very same epirotic polyphony is appropriated by art music. It was composed in 1970 by the Greek composer Dimitris Dragatakis. I'm imagining that you're not intimate with his works, but anyway, he is a significant figure in modern Greek music. And you'll hear, I think, I'm just going to play the opening of it, but you'll hear that the very specific aura created by that polyphony is without compromise to an essentially modernist musical idiom. What you hear at this opening is, first, the folk idiom a little bit in the distance, and then the beginnings of its transformation. If we took it a bit further, the folk idiom which you had at the beginning come emerges again into the foreground. It sort of comes out and then in again in that sort of sort of way. Now, I want to track back to the immediate post-war years and to shade in some of the backgrounds that made a peace like that possible. And here I'm focusing on the border that separated Greece from its northern communist neighbours from the late 1940s to the early 1990s. We're, of course, in the Cold War era, and you'll be aware of the context, the Yalta Declaration, the ensuing Greek civil war, with communists persecuted in huge numbers, many of them fleeing across the borders. You'll also be aware that as the political border firmed up, politicians were increasingly interventionist in cultural life, including, of course, music. Just prior to this, in the late 1930s, an increasingly polarized politics had drawn sharp ideological lines between ideas of the nation and ideas of the new. The two were becoming less and less compatible. And this was especially the case in those parts of Southeast Europe where right-wing and eventually puppet governments were in place. It was actually at this point, the late 30s, that the code-switching, conventionally associated with Cold War politics, really began. Cold War, of course, raised the stakes. The politics were now at the level of the superpower, and the codes were made explicit. Folk-based repertories on one side, and avant-garde on the other. And we all know, you know better than I, about music and politics in the communist bloc. But it's only relatively recently that we've become aware of the activities of the Congress of Cultural Freedom, the US Information Service, and indeed the CIA in promoting a European avant-garde. Or at least in making room, creating space within which an avant-garde could develop. I think it's wrong to be too straightforward about causalities here. A huge body of recent scholarship along these lines has corrected an earlier very blatant asymmetry in musical scholarship dealing with the Cold War. There was propaganda on both sides. Now, Greece has hardly figured at all in these recent debates, and it's just a tiny glimpse into that largely untold Greek story that I want to offer you now. Greece's dependence on the US during the later stages of the Civil War, closely tied, obviously, to Cold War imperatives, ensured that it became hardly less of a client state than its Slavonic neighbours. And along with that came programmes of cultural aid. In the immediate post-war years, it was actually the British who called the shots, notably through the British Council. I happen to live within walking distance of the National Archives in London, so I spend many an afternoon working in there. And if you look there, you can find some rather intriguing exchanges between the British Council in Athens and the Foreign Office on these matters. Some of it's actually quite amusing, really. There's a request to send modern English music, quote, urgently by air. They have nothing here but Vaughan Williams and Quilter. Or listen to this from the British Council's annual report to the Foreign Office in 1946. I'm quoting here. I think it's rather remarkable. It is felt that Russia, this is the report to the Foreign Office from the British Council in Athens. It is felt that Russia, in spite of the vast advances which she has made under Soviet rule, and in spite of the immense interest of her social, political, economic experiment, differs rather too widely, both in her problems and in her mentality, to have much to offer to Greece. While America, though interested platonically in Greece, and a source of inexhaustible material supply, cannot really understand or help the Greeks in their present situation. In other words, it's up to us, the British, to intervene. And 2 years later, that report would have been inconceivable, and not just because of its benign view of Soviet rule. By then, everything had changed. If you leaf through the pages of the Anglo-Hellenic Review in the late 40s, you can almost literally watch the British withdraw culturally, handing over to the West Germans and their American mentors from around 1950 onwards. So, in 1952, the first Goethe Institute outside Germany was founded in Athens, and it promoted highly ambitious series of Goethe Institute workshops for contemporary music. And in the same year, 52, a series of American concerts was initiated, funded by the US Information Service, i.e. the CIA, and held at their film room on Monday evenings with the explicit aim of introducing contemporary music to Greece. The way it worked, actually, was that typically the programs would consist of recorded versions of American music, including symphonic repertoire and so on. But then there would also be live performances of Greek music, usually chamber work. So that was the standard format for this. In this way, Greek modernism, a failed project in the pre-war years, witnessed the reception of Mitropoulos and Skalkottas, became part of an official culture marked by an allegiance to the West and sharply distinguished from the rival culture of the Eastern Bloc. There is a whole, one could talk about the failure of modernism in the pre-war years at some length, how people like Mitropoulos and Skalkottas were both in a way squeezed out by the prevailing orthodoxy of the so-called Greek National School under Manolis Kalamiris. That's the broad picture. However, if we focus on what composers said and did, rather than on which side of the ideological divide they found themselves, we'll be struck not by the differences, but by the commonalities between Greece and its northern communist neighbours. And I want to suggest that these commonalities were encapsulated in two competing narratives. Narratives that between them shaped the subsequent development of art music in the Balkans. The first was a Western-orientated narrative of emancipation, facilitated by Great War politics in Greece, impeded by them in Yugoslavia and Bulgaria. And I'll pick up on that again in a moment. The second narrative was a quest for Balkan roots and Balkan identities. For a period in the 1950s, Greece and Yugoslavia tried to revive some of their earlier collaborative ventures of the early 1930s, particularly. There was a Yugoslav concert in Athens in 1952. There were visits to Belgrade from Manolis Kalamiris, the senior figure in Greek music. There were long eulogistic articles on music in Yugoslavia in the Greek press. And there were plans for a series of festivals in Athens, Belgrade, and Istanbul. I won't elaborate on these collaborative programs. In the end, they foundered. And they did so primarily because by the late 50s, Greece and Yugoslavia were, to be frank, more interested in their separate relationships with the West than they were in each other. In other words, the first narrative began to take precedence over the second. That first narrative, I called it a narrative of emancipation, reached a key stage in the early 60s, culminating in two festivals, one on each side of the political boundary. The first was the Zagreb Biennale, the channel through which Yugoslav composers were able to merge seamlessly and easily into the mainstreams of European modernism. Now, one of the principal reasons the Biennale was able to survive was that the organizers were in a position to play the Soviets off against the Americans in the sponsorship stakes. Milko Kelemen, who's the power behind the Zagreb Biennale, has actually written quite amusingly about how he did just that. You know, if you wanted sponsorship from the Americans, you just told them that the Russians had sponsored this and so on and so forth. The other festival was the Hellenic Weeks of Contemporary Music, inaugurated in Athens in 1966. Now, one could say a lot about this. The very first festival was extraordinary in its programming, not least for the kind of canonization of Schoenberg, and at the same time, the linked to that, the belated habilitation of Skalkottas in Greece. But I actually just want to draw your attention to the pattern of sponsorship, where you can see very clearly the context within which Greek modernism had its moment in the sun. For the first festival, 1966, the principal external sponsor was the Goethe Institute. For the second, in 67, the cultural office of the US Embassy joined in, and the program reflected that. Then, for the third, 1968, organized note within the period of the junta, the right-wing dictatorship in Greece, there was a single sponsor, the Ford Foundation, one of the CIA's so-called quiet channels, and exactly the same was true of the fourth festival in 71. For the last of the festivals in 76, which are now post-junta, all external funding was withdrawn. And it's, if you actually look at the program book, front page, it's very obvious from the huge list of local sponsors that there have been a desperate attempt to secure local funding. You know, look at the one just before, and there's only one sponsor, the Ford Foundation. Now there's an enormous list of just about every bank in Athens and all the rest of it trying to scrape the money together. The festival failed in the end because, unlike Yugoslavia, Greece was at the mercy of one of the two superpowers. By then, the 1970s, my second narrative of homecoming, of Balkan identities, of the quest for roots, had in any case reasserted itself on both sides of the political divide. I won't elaborate on this. Serbia was actually a key player in this. Beyond saying that the violin concerto you heard by Dragatakis just now belongs to this work, this quest for archetypes and roots. In this music, as we heard briefly earlier, the distant strains of epirotic polyphony are entirely at home. Dragatakis was from this region, from Nicopolis. The marriage of archaism and modernism, characteristic of that concerto, has seemed to offer an identity to many composers in recent decades, perhaps especially around the fringes of Europe, and this may have some meaning here in Estonia. And I mean, of course, a self-consciously constructed identity. This is where my second story differs from my first. In both, music is hijacked by politics. But in the second, it talks back. If we take a bird's eye view of post-war art music in the Balkans, what we see, I think, is that while political appropriations pulled Greece and its northern neighbours apart, the talking back actually drew them together through shared narratives of emancipation and of Balkan identities. Naturally, the demise of the Cold War changed many things. But even before that demise, the political value of the pedigreed codes, folklorism and avant-garde, had lessened hugely. The truth is, the sad irony actually, that if most composers wanted to insist that their activities were apolitical in the late communist years, that they transcended politics, most politicians saw those activities as simply not worth claiming. I want to return to epirotic polyphony one last time to introduce my third story, but this time I want to consider its appropriation by popular music. When I discussed this polyphonic style at the outset, I mentioned that Albanian varieties are often characterized by a rhythmicized eson, a drone. I'm going to play an example of that now, performed by a secondary ensemble. It's actually an example of what Alf Arvidsson was talking about when he was saying, you know, that these things that have been performed naturally by people for generations suddenly become technical challenges for young people who try to imitate them. So this is an example of that. A song called Fustane Verde, which really means costume, the tradition for the costume. Fustane Verde, limo. Same song by the Albanian pop folk diva Maja Litskaya, known commonly just as Maja. When I was in Tirana in February 2008, this song was sort of everywhere, you know, when you turn the radio on or watch music TV. This was just everywhere. So this is Maja. Performance style in pop folk is rooted in a specific tradition, a specific place. Compare it with this song performed by the Macedonian Albanian Muharram Ameti. you who know about such things, and there is actually one person in the room who has written about such things, partly me, the Aman Aman at the opening there will have been enough to establish a link between this Albanian popular music and the Greek Amanes, and by way of that, the earlier Ottoman Gazel. We might say then that those two recordings appropriate respectively traditional music and Oriental music. And in truth, the two categories are more often than not conflated in pop folk. This is true right across the Balkans today. It was in 2003 that I first really became aware of this kind of music. In September of that year, I joined several thousand others on a trek to the Olympic Stadium in Sarajevo to hear a concert given by the popular Bosnian singer Khalid Bezic, cult figure of so-called newly composed folk music, or neo-folk. Even I could see that a very particular space had been carved out by drawing together elements of folk music, popular music, and Oriental music. Now, almost all commentators on popular music in this region, including that other person I mentioned earlier, feel impelled to problematize the Oriental part of that trilogy. In some cases, the debates tend to unfold within national narratives. How far can these Oriental elements be understood as a legitimate part of a native inheritance? How far are they foreign imports that in some way threaten that native inheritance? That kind of thing is very common in writing about Orientalism in pop music in the Balkans. And it's this, of course, that prompts me to extend the Greek border further eastwards to Turkey. To track this, we need to drop back to the 1980s, at which time the main streams of popular music in Greece began to look towards eastern neighbours. They also looked towards northern neighbours, but they did look to the east. One would refer first to a rebetika revival that had major implications for Greek identity, and secondly to developing links between Greek pop and Turkish arabesque. There was increasing interactivity between Greek, Turkish, and Egyptian musicians during the 1980s, including exchanges, song translation across three languages, and collaborative projects. There are even recordings made in which the Turkish and Greek languages appear together. The sense of cultural crossover in all this was palpable. Promoting reciprocity between nations where traditional rivalries served to obscure a shared heritage. One thinks of Julia Kristeva's longing to reconnect, or even more actively of Joseph Nye's soft pop. Questions of identity seem to have been working themselves out through the Oriental component of pop folk in Greece. This was, I remind you, the post-Kunta period, a period of self-scrutiny and self-definition, with the old debates about language and double-descendedness, Byzantine, Hellenic, coming into very sharp focus. The 90s marked a new era, of course. One might venture that the deluge of Greek pop folk at that time exhibited both subcultural and countercultural tendencies, to revert to a terminology that's already been used a bit in this conference. With its trash lyrics and synthesizers, it was part of a development associated with the emergent fantasy world of TV music channels right across southern Europe and the eastern Mediterranean. Just think of the Berlusconi television empire. I'm tempted to say a monument to kitsch, if ever there was one. Yet the Eastern elements in this music seem to plumb deeper well, suggestive of a counterculture, an element of resistance, one might say, in the face of the tsunami of American and Americanized mass culture. It's perhaps tempting to think of the Oriental signifiers in pop folk in the wider region as a way of reinscribing an Ottoman inheritance into Balkan identities. But that doesn't quite cover it. The nature of the Oriental element suggests that more conventionally Orientalist glamorizing or self-exoticizing modes were also at work. You might sloganize these two separate Easts in a way as backward and Balkan and glamorous and global. The ambivalence is undoubtedly at its most marked in Greece, where there was an imperative to be absolutely modern. This is European Greece. But where the continuing presence and the problematized heritage of Rebetika and the Bouzouki could not be ignored. In this respect, there are significant differences between the pop folk traditions of Greece and those of the Slavonic Balkans. But the commonalities are there too. Indeed, they reach right across the mass culture of Southeast Europe, and in ways that seem to belie the recent political history of the region. Such, at least, is the conclusion of one informant. I quote, "A common Balkan music is emerging, where you can't tell whether it's Serbian, Bulgarian, Greek, Albanian, or Turkish." Generic labels differ. Turbo folk, Sevda rock, Chalga, Maneli, Laika, Musica Popolare. But the musical materials flow like Bauman's Liquid. I don't know if you know Zygmunt Bauman's book, Liquid Modernities. Flow freely across the boundaries. In some ways, the closest parallel, unlikely though it may seem, is with 19th century nationalisms in art music, where again, each nation presented a variant on a uniform culture. We've talked about it already. While at the same time competitively elevating, asserting, and promoting its uniqueness. The general practice in both cases was to allow a repertory of generalized idioms to serve as all-purpose musical signifiers, inflecting the aesthetic center, to use Philip Bowman's language. Specificity then resides in a poetics of intention and reception. We discussed cosmopolitan nationalism. Philip Bowman's work reminds us that exactly this mechanism has been paraded before a much wider public in the form of the Eurovision Song Contest, which some have liked to view as a mass cultural site, either for negotiating national identities within Europe, or alternatively for a cultural reunification of politically fragmented spaces. Greece's song in 2001, which achieved third place, provided one model of just such an ethnic presentation, followed by Turkey in the winning song of 2003, and again by Greece in the winning song of 2005. It's a model that, as Bowman articulates it, places Europe at the center of the song and the nation at its periphery. Actually, I don't know if you followed it in 2010, but I mean, Goran Bregovic's song for Serbia in 2010 couldn't have been more explicit. Ovilje Balka, this is the Balkans. I mean, such songs are not actually going to win the Eurovision Song Contest today, but that anyway isn't the aim. I mean, for most of these Balkan nations, that's a kind of nightmare scenario to actually win it and then have to host it again the next year. A more aggressive interpretation of pop folk would note that the symbolic value of both folk and Oriental elements has been hugely complicated by loss of memory, spurious nostalgia, the experience of exile. In Jean Baudrillard's terms, these elements become a kind of facade. There are two points that might be made about this. One is that such a dislocation within the sign renders the music especially susceptible to political appropriation. To borrow Baudrillard's language, we might say that the system of signs now lend themselves to all systems of equivalence. Think of Turbofolk and Milosevic in Serbia. And the other is that the simulacra have a capacity to replace reality, to become themselves a new reality, effectively negating the sign. The territory no longer precedes the map, was Baudrillard's famous formulation. This may be relevant to the representations of a musical East that became part and parcel of first neo-folk and then pop folk. In this particular imaginary, this myth of the East, only the simulacra were left. In my first story about epirotic polyphony, I suggested that an existing local culture had been divided by the politics of the nation state, split between rival claimants and also between majorities and minorities. If we feel any sense of responsibility towards that music, if we want to protect it in ways that UNESCO doesn't even think about, it may be because it lacks any real capacity to talk back to the political world. In my second story, a divided politics both created and actively promoted a divided culture, but the cultural world then worked to cross the divide. That was then. In today's world, native scholars, disenchanted in the main, it has to be said, fight the corner for art music in a hostile environment, struggling to gain recognition and funding from successive governments. In the process, they are inclined once again to construct musical traditions as intrinsically national, unique brands that might hold their own in a global cultural marketplace. This is understandable, but it's not particularly comfortable to see division originating from within rather than from without the institution of art. We need to recognize chauvinism for what it is, and we need to acknowledge that it can come from us as well as from politicians. My third story, one of the three, this is the one where soft power may indeed be a viable option, not just because this is the music closest to most people's lives, but because youth today often seem to resist, so it seems to me, notions of culture as something that is fixed, something to which one is born. But for us as scholars, well, we're reduced to passive commentary. There's little we can do, I suspect, other than to watch and to wonder. Thank you very much for your attention.